we're going to talk today a little bit about the Civil War and the Navy's role in it, and you're the expert in that matter. I don't have a fancy introduction for you, but you are Professor Emeritus from Princeton University, and you've written a number of great books, including a Pulitzer Prize-winning book on the Civil War. And the book we're talking about is published by the University of North Carolina Press called War on the Waters. Could you describe a little bit, Professor, about how you got started writing this book and what prompted you to write a book about the Navy's role in the Civil War?
Well, I've always been interested in the role of the Navy in the Civil War, and the more work I've done on the Civil War, the more convinced that I became that the Navy's role, especially the Union Navy's role, was crucial to ultimate Northern victory in the war. So when the opportunity came along to write a book on that subject in a series called The Littlefield History of the Civil War, about 15 volumes being published now during the course of the sesquicentennial, edited by my good friend Gary Gallagher at the University of Virginia, I jumped at the chance to do a book on the Navy and to provide the story of both navies, the Union and the Confederate navies, and the roles that they played in the Civil War, which I, as I said, I'm convinced have not received their just due.
Yes, sir. You hit on a number of topics in this book, I think, which are germane to the present military situations. I'm kind of surprised at how modern the Civil War turned out to be, but some of it had to do with military preparedness. When the U.S. Navy got caught up in the Civil War, were they really ready to accomplish the missions that were assigned to them by the President and the Secretary of the Navy?
Well, they were not really ready, but they were more ready than the Army. The United States Navy on the eve of the Civil War had about 7,000 men, officers and men. The United States Army at the on the eve of the Civil War was only about 16,000 men. In the first year of the war, the Navy increased to about 30 or 40,000, and the Army increased to about 700,000. The United States Navy had actually gone through a period of reform and modernization in the 1850s. Half a dozen state-of-the-art steam frigates, 44-gun steam frigates, had been built in the latter half of the 1850s, and an even larger number of steam sloops, 24-gun, fast, streamlined ships had been built. So the Navy was, while too small to carry out the principal objective of the United States Navy during the war, which was the blockade of 3,500 miles of Confederate coast, was had the core, had the basis for a rapid buildup that by the end of the Civil War had totaled, I think, 621 warships altogether during the course of the Civil War. Some of them pretty small and rickety craft, but a lot of them very modern, state-of-the-art vessels, including about 50 ironclads of the new Monitor class.
I really, this is Sal, by the way. Sorry I was a little late coming on. I really enjoyed the book for a lot of reasons. First of all, being a history buff, but also having read what I thought was a lot about the Civil War. But I think your book really covers a gap in that it goes into that second and third layer about the Civil War that you really only get if you're doing larger volumes, because it is a very much of a land-centric war in many respects. One of the interesting things that I saw is there's always that rather humorous argument, that the U.S. Civil War is at the war between the states, but the top shelf admiral that fought for the Union during the Civil War, Admiral Farragut, kind of like General Pemberton in the Vicksburg campaign, who was fighting for the South, is a little more complicated than that. What if you could share with the listeners the background of Admiral Farragut and how that adds some layers to the discussion of the nature of our Civil War?
Well, Farragut was a Southerner. He came from a Southern family. He had been born in Tennessee. One of his sisters lived in New Orleans. A brother lived in Mississippi. He married a woman from Virginia, and when she died, he married had a second marriage also to a woman from Virginia. And during the antebellum decades, when he was first a lieutenant, then a commander, then a captain in the United States Navy, roaming the seven seas, when he was on shore, he made his home in Norfolk, Virginia. So one would have thought he would have sided with the Confederacy, but not at all. He had spent his entire career since the age of nine, when he had been a midshipman, started out his career as a midshipman in the United States Navy, and he remained loyal to that institution and to the American flag during the course of the war. And it certainly was lucky for the Union cause that he did, because I think more than any other single individual, except maybe Ulysses S. Grant, he was responsible for ultimate Northern victory in the war.
When the Navy started out in the Civil War, its ranks were filled with captains, because I believe at the time that was the highest rank.
That's correct.
The Navy. And it was all on the basis of seniority, and until sometime during the war. Why did they change from a seniority system into a different approach to promoting people?
Well, a few years earlier, there had been an attempt to weed out the dead wood that was created by the seniority system. Many of the senior captains were in their 60s and 70s. That had not gone over very well in the Navy, but once the war started and it became clear that there were younger men far down on the captain's list who would be needed to command the ships that would carry the flag in the Union effort during the Civil War, Congress gave the power to the Secretary of Navy, Gideon Welles, to ignore seniority and in appointing commanders of the various squadrons that would maintain the blockade. And so Farragut, for example, I think was 37th on the captain's list, the seniority list, when he was appointed commander of the West Gulf Blockading Squadron and given the principal task early in the war of capturing New Orleans, which he managed to do quite spectacularly. Samuel Francis DuPont, I think, was 16th on the seniority list when he was given command of the first of the Atlantic Blockading Squadron. Then it was divided into two, and he was commander of the South Atlantic Blockading Squadron. His fleet captured New Orleans. And so it went. They managed to use the authority given by Congress to ignore seniority to promote some of the ablest men despite their relatively low rank on the seniority list.
Having read your book and some of your descriptions of him, I think that this individual might actually like this, how I'm going to describe him here, but especially towards the last quarter of the book, it really started to sink in with me that one of the most important players on the Union side of the Civil War was somebody who I would hear in the background, but not any real description about how important he was and how long-lived he was in the position he had during the war, and his really close relationship with President Lincoln. Who was Gideon Welles, and what characterized the way that he went about his business and his responsibilities during the war?
Well, Welles came up through a career in journalism and in politics, and not a career in the Navy. He was from Connecticut, and he had edited a newspaper, more than one newspaper, during his career in Connecticut. For a short time in the 1840s, he was under President Polk for about 2 years. He had received appointment as head of the Bureau of Supply for the Navy, but that was the full extent of his naval experience before 1861. And basically, he was appointed as Secretary of the Navy because Lincoln needed to have at least one New Englander in his cabinet. And Welles had been a strong supporter of Lincoln in the election of 1860, and he did have this rather minimal naval background. And so Lincoln made him Secretary of the Navy, and that turned out to be an inspired appointment because Welles was a very good administrator. He was efficient. We know from the diary that he kept that he could write very clear orders. He was decisive, and as you've said, he was close to Lincoln, and so he turned out to be one of the best cabinet appointments that Lincoln made, and he served as Secretary of the Navy for the entire 4 years of the war, and he oversaw the buildup of the Navy from the, I think it was something like 42 vessels in commission in 1861, some of them pretty obsolete sailing vessels, to the eventual total of some 621 naval ships during the entire course of the war. He was fairly early in his commitment to building ironclads, and it was under his auspices and leadership, of course, that the Monitor was built just in time to confront the Confederate ship, the CSS Virginia, which had been converted from the USS Merrimack that the Confederates had seized at the Norfolk Navy Yard at the beginning of the war in one of the most dramatic ship-to-ship actions during the course of the Civil War, the clash of those two ironclads, the first in the history. And if it hadn't been for in naval history, and if it hadn't been for Welles's leadership, that might well have turned out to be a disaster for the Union cause.
Yeah, I really enjoyed learning more about Welles, and I also enjoyed the fact that you put in a lot of these small stories of the war that point out a lot of young and young is a relative term, of course, considering the way people were promoted those days, but younger officers who took some pretty big chances. And I think of the attack on the Albemarle on up in Plymouth and in North Carolina, and a lot of other stories that you put into this fairly short book, but rather detailed. Was there any particular story like that stuck in your mind as something you really enjoyed learning more about that you hadn't known about before you set out to write this book?
Well, I think the exploit that you mentioned, William Barker Cushing's attack on the Albemarle in October of 1864, was one of the more fascinating stories, and it had a deeper background because Cushing had been an intrepid lieutenant commanding ships that basically in 1863 especially penetrated behind Confederate lines up the Cape Fear River toward Wilmington to carry out raids and intelligence gathering exploits that helped to strengthen the blockade of Wilmington. And it was that record of daring actions behind enemy lines that caused Welles and Captain Lee, Samuel Phillips Lee, to assign Cushing the task of going up the Roanoke River to Plymouth. With a motorized dinghy, and to plant a torpedo on the hull of the CSS Albemarle, which had raised havoc with the Union fleet in the North Carolina Sounds, and blow her out of the water and sink her. That's led eventually to the biography of Cushing that was called Lincoln's Commando. Because that's in effect what he was a kind of naval commando that had daringly carried out a variety of raids and then climaxed by this really terrific exploit in October of 1864, sinking the Albemarle.
You know, that's, I was just exchanging a couple of texts with one of our regulars here, and as I was reading that story, I went, this guy should have been, you know, our first naval special warfare guy, because it would read like a Civil War era steampunk type of SEAL operation. Really an incredible story. I thought you laid it out real well.
That's a good comparison. It was kind of a SEAL type operation. You're right.
Yes, sir. And my co-host mentioned early on in the show, there's a lot in the book that really, it's not history. It's applicable to what we're doing today. And I think also for, you know, officers on active duty right now, there's a few lessons there that apply real well. And one of the ones that had me be laughing a little bit, because often the time officers can find that the Navy has plans for them in their career that officer might not particularly want. You know, somebody may want to go to sea, but they have a certain skill that the powers that be with, you know, that's cute and all, but I need you over here doing what you don't want to do, because what you don't like doing or you prefer to do something else, you actually do this real well, so we're going to keep you here. And that was Dahlgren. Most people know the Dahlgren gun, but he was a serving officer who was responsible for that pivotal weapon that really made a difference in the war. But could you outline a little bit what was the career catch-22 that Dahlgren found himself in, and how he finally managed to work the system to get what he really wanted, which was to get to sea?
Well, Dahlgren was, of course, an ordnance expert. He had invented the Dahlgren gun. He had been head of the Ordnance Department of the United States Navy on the eve of the Civil War, and during the early months of the Civil War, he was the commandant of the Washington Navy Yard, one of the most important of the Northern Navy Yards. But in the Navy at that time, as I think is probably also the case today, advancement came through duty at sea. And, of course, Dahlgren realized this, and over again in the antebellum period, and then even more diligently in the early months of the Civil War, he requested assignment to command of a ship or command of a squadron. But he was so valuable in his capacity as commandant of the Navy Yard and head of the Ordnance Bureau that Wells kept telling him, no, I can't spare you. You're making a greater contribution here. But, of course, as a consequence, he saw other officers moving ahead of him on the promotion list because of their exploits, both on blue water and brown water, since the Navy was involved in the river warfare as well. Dahlgren actually became very friendly with President Lincoln. Lincoln liked to go down to the Navy Yard in Washington and observe some of the weapons testing, and he and Dahlgren became quite close. And it was through that avenue that Dahlgren finally got Lincoln on his side, and Dahlgren wanted to be given command of the ironclad attack on Charleston in the spring of 1863. Wells didn't want to give him that that command because it was Samuel Francis DuPont was the commander of the South Atlantic blockade fleet, and it was his duty and responsibility and privilege to command the attack on Charleston. But eventually Lincoln persuaded Wells to give Dahlgren a command of one of the ironclads, and Dahlgren was willing to accept that. Lincoln also pressed Wells to promote Dahlgren to rear admiral. There had already been several appointments of rear admiral, Farragut, DuPont, and a couple of others had been appointed to admiral in the summer of 1862, and Dahlgren felt he was being left behind because of his lack of sea duty, and he was caught in that kind of catch-22. You don't get promoted if you don't have sea duty, but if you're so good at the job, the Secretary of Navy won't give you sea duty so that you can get ahead. Well, what happened was that Andrew Hull Foote was appointed to succeed, who's also an admiral, to succeed DuPont as commander of the South Atlantic Blockading Fleet after the failure of the attack on Charleston. And DuPont started making excuses for his failure, blaming others. He offended both Lincoln and Wells because of his attitude after the failure of the attack. And so he was basically kicked upstairs to a desk job in Washington. And Andrew Hull Foote, who had made his mark in the river warfare in the Western Rivers in 1862, was given command of the South Atlantic Fleet, but then he suddenly died from Bright's disease. And Dahlgren got the command in July of 1863 and kept that command the rest of the war. But it was basically, I think, his friendship with Lincoln, as well as as the perceived unfairness of keeping him in a lower rank just because he had not had sea duty, because he was so good at his ordnance job, that enabled, that caused Lincoln to use his influence, his power as commander-in-chief to get Dahlgren that command in 1863.
You've already hit on it, but I was going to ask you about the, I mean, we've got the Anaconda strategy, we've got the squeeze being put on the South, trying to cut off its logistics flow in various ways. But you tipped into it, right into it, which was the riverine warfare, much of which, as you note in the book, was initially started out by the Army and then somewhat co-opted, I guess, maybe the right word, by the Navy. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. It was clear that the network of navigable rivers in what was then called the West, the Cumberland River and the Tennessee River, which flowed through the state of Tennessee and Kentucky and then into the Ohio River, and of course the Mississippi River itself, that these rivers penetrated into the heartland of the Confederacy, and that whoever controlled those rivers would be a big leg up on winning the war. But because this was in the interior of the country, the initial responsibility for contracting to build gunboats and purchase steamboats to be converted into gunboats was given to the War Department. But, of course, the War Department doesn't have any personnel capable of commanding ships. So the Navy provided the officers. The Army provided the funding, and civilian riverboat men provided most of the crews. This sounds like an unpromising combination for success, but it turned out to work very well in the winter and spring of 1862, when this composite Army-Navy operation on the Western Rivers captured several Confederate forts, gained control of much of the Tennessee and Cumberland River, and eventually much of the Mississippi River as well. But that anomaly of Army control but naval operation came to an end in October 1862. Congress authorized the Navy to take over complete control of riverine operations, and for the rest of the war, it was a naval operation in law as well as in fact. And it was very successful. The Union Navy, with the support of the Army in many cases, especially in the Vicksburg campaign, eventually gained complete control of these crucial navigable rivers, especially the Mississippi River, and sliced the Confederacy in two parts and partly into three parts through the control of these rivers.
when people think of big naval battles of the war, and I believe on the cover of your book is one of the things that comes to most people's mind, that's the rather dramatic picture of Farragut in the Battle of Mobile Bay. But there were a lot of other battles that we might have a ship named after here or there, but people really don't know the pivotal role they played in the series of events that eventually led to the Union victory. But what was the Battle of Port Royal, and why was that so important?
The Battle of Port Royal took place in November 1861. It was one of the first major naval operations in the war. Port Royal Sound, or Port Royal Bay, is one of the largest natural harbors on the South Atlantic coast. It lies between Charleston and Savannah, and the Union Navy decided that it needed a blockade base to support the blockade fleet of the South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida coast. And so the largest fleet in the war so far was assembled in October of 1861 and sailed south from Hampton Roads in Virginia with sealed orders. They didn't know where they were going until they got to sea to attack the two Confederate forts, Fort Beauregard and Fort Walker, flanking the entrance to Port Royal Bay. And in a kind of unique tactical operation made possible by steam power, the Union warships steamed in an oval pattern between these two forts, which were about 3 miles apart on either side of the entrance to the Port Royal Bay. Using their broadside guns to fire first on one fort and then on the other fort, and in the process completely subdued both of those forts, and without the aid of the army gained control of Port Royal Bay and established a huge naval base there, and the army eventually fanned out along the South Carolina and Georgia Sea Islands, the barrier islands there, and gained complete control of those and shut down most of the blockade running into various ports along the South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida coast, except Charleston, which was very difficult to blockade. The Battle of Port Royal was one of the first real Union victories in the war, early in the war, November 1861, and gave a large boost to Northern morale, as well as the successful operation that gained some control of so much of the South Atlantic coastline.
I hate to get away from the Atlantic again, but I want to go back to the river, because there's a part in there that in my young naval officer education, which I admit was shortly after the Civil War, but I don't think I ever heard of the Ellet Rams before I read your book. Could you talk about those a little bit and what their effect was on the riverine warfare?
I'm sorry, about the ironclads, did you say?
The Ellet Rams?
Oh, the Ellis Rams. Oh, yes.
Ellis Rams.
Yeah. Well, you know, in ancient naval warfare, ramming was a technique. These were this was before the era of the gunpowder, and that had gone into complete eclipse in the era of the big sailing ships, the ships of the line, frigates, with their 70 or 80 guns. But steam power, especially on the rivers, made possible again the use of ramming as a technique against an enemy warship. The Confederates had actually done that in March of 1862 with the CSS Virginia, which sank the USS Cumberland by ramming it. The Confederate Defense Fleet at New Orleans in April of 1862 had carried out ramming efforts against the Union warships under Farragut that eventually captured New Orleans. The Confederate River Defense Fleet near Memphis and north of Memphis on the Mississippi River in the spring of 1862 also carried out several attacks ramming Union warships north of Memphis at Plum Run Point and in other battles in the spring of 1862. And the Union finally got the message, and they built some rams themselves under the Ellis brothers. These were actually contracted for. They were actually bought by the War Department under Secretary of War Stanton, who was a believer in the ramming technique. They bought several stout river boats and then completely rebuilt them with oak beams running fore and aft and then braced crosswise and heavy oak bow, reinforced bow. And in the Battle of Memphis on June 6th, 1862, these Union rams got up maximum speed and went down river against the Confederate River Defense Fleet in Memphis. And the first one that struck one of the Confederate boats virtually sliced it in half. And then the Union River rams managed to damage and sink two or three other Confederate ships as well. And as a consequence, that meant that ramming techniques had returned from the days of pre-gunpowder days as a major Union weapon and a Confederate weapon as well in the Civil War.
I'll reinforce my co-host's desire to stick with riverine. One of the things that really hit me like a bolt because of its applicability today, but also the fact that I've spent some time on the rivers that you were discussing and visualizing was just really impressive. But the riverine forces were used extensively in a very successful counterinsurgency campaign as a solution to a problem that was developing. Talk a little bit about how the Union figured out how they could use a riverine in counterinsurgency and how that impacted that challenge that they were experiencing from the rebels being rebels.
Well, what happened was that the Union forces by 1863 had gained pretty complete control of these western rivers with the fall of Vicksburg and Port Hudson in July 1863. They had gained complete control of the Mississippi River from Minnesota down to the Gulf of Mexico. But the Confederates didn't give up, and they carried on shore-based guerrilla actions against Union supply ships operating on these rivers. The Confederates were in groups of about 20 or 30, well armed with rifles, but sometimes with a couple of field artillery batteries, would conceal themselves in the woods along the riverbank, we'll say on the Mississippi River, and attack Union supply ships. So to counter this guerrilla operation, David Dixon Porter, who had become commander of the Mississippi River Squadron in October 1862 and had been instrumental in the Vicksburg campaign, created a kind of counter-guerrilla operation. He bought a whole lot of shallow draft river steamboats, converted them into what were called tinclads. Some of them had a draft of only about 2 feet, 24 inches. They could go far up on the shore, on the edge of the rivers, or far up on the tributaries of the rivers to counter these guerrilla operations. And they also created the Marine Brigade. The Ellis iron rams were converted into a Marine Brigade They would carry horses, and they would land the horses to go after the guerrillas. So from the boats. So in the last 2 years of the war, from the summer of 1863 until the end of the war, there was a kind of cat and mouse game going on over hundreds and hundreds of miles of the mostly the Mississippi River, but also the Tennessee River, where these lightly armored, shallow draft Union gunboats would land troops, usually armed sailors, and go after Confederate guerrillas, or would shell them from the rivers themselves and drive them away. They also developed a convoy system on these western rivers to put together a convoy of 30 or 40 supply boats to supply the Union Army forces in Tennessee and later in Mississippi and in Georgia, and would put these 30 or 40 supply boats in charge of half a dozen gunboats that would be spaced throughout the convoy, at the head of it and the rear of it and in the middle of it, to deal with the guerrillas that operated along the shores. So not only did you have these hit-and-run actions by the guerrillas and then the response by the River Navy, but you also had the development of a fairly sophisticated convoy system that was probably the most effective weapon in overcoming the Confederate guerrilla operations operating along the shores of these rivers.
Yeah, I think that one of the other things I got out of the book, which I was appreciative of, was how this asymmetric warfare that the South was forced to fight caused them to be very creative in a lot of their approaches to matters. And you mentioned in the book the first submarines, some of the tactics used by they're not really blockade runners, but the ships that Raphael Semmes had. Could you kind of discuss how creative they were in some aspect? And of course, there's their own brand of improvised explosive devices with the torpedoes that we would now call mines. Could you talk about that?
Sure. The Confederate Secretary of the Navy, Stephen Mallory, realized that the Confederacy could never match the United States Navy in the number of ships and firepower. So they decided that they needed to turn to technological innovation and operational innovation to try to match maybe even overmatch the firepower and just the sheer numbers of ships in the Union Navy. They were the first to develop an ironclad for that purpose, but even more to the point, they began experimenting with what they called torpedoes, which were basically floating naval mines. In the rivers and estuaries to counter the Union warships moving into these rivers or along the coastline and into the estuaries of the rivers along the coast. And that became one of the most successful of Confederate naval tactics. Their mines, or torpedoes as they continued to call them, most of them didn't work very well, but enough of them worked so that they sank or damaged a total of, I believe it was, 42 Union warships during the course of the war, more than anything else. That was the most successful of the naval tactics that the Confederacy used. And they went one step further than that, using torpedoes. They developed first a class of small, cigar-shaped, semi-submersible, steam-powered boats with a spar off extending 15 or 20 feet off the bow, at the end of which there was a contact torpedo or contact mine. They managed to damage the USS New Ironsides with one of these. They also managed to blow a hole in the side of the USS Minnesota in the Hampton Roads with that. And it was only one step beyond that to an actual submarine, which the Confederates also developed, the H.L. Hunley, which could go underwater, carried a mine or a contact torpedo on a bow spar. And in February 1864, they actually ventured out from Charleston and sank one of the Union blockade ships, which was the first example in history of a submarine sinking an enemy ship. The Hunley itself also went down, but it has been recovered, and one can go and see it at the Charleston Navy Yard today. Another tactic of the Confederate Navy were the Commerce Raiders. They converted some merchant ships into fairly fast sea-going ships, but for the most part they built or bought ships in English shipyards, British shipyards. The two most famous were the CSS Florida and the CSS Alabama, both of them built at Birkenhead on the Mersey River right across from Liverpool, in England in the spring and summer of 1864. This violated the British Foreign Enlistment Act and violated British neutrality, but a very clever and smart Confederate operator, James Bullock, managed to outwit the Union diplomats in Britain and get both of these ships to sea in 1862, and for the next 2 years they roamed the oceans sinking any American merchant ships they could find, and they found a lot of them. The Alabama alone sank I believe as many as 64 Union ships, sank or ransomed 64 American merchant ships in its less than 2 years, from August 1864 until it was sunk in turn by the USS Kearsarge in June of 1864. Started out in August 1862. This basically drove the American merchant fleet off the high seas. They converted to foreign registry. Insurance rates went way up. It probably did not help the Confederate war effort that much, but it certainly did help Confederate morale and damage Northern morale. It also forced the diversion of many ships, Union warships, from blockade duty to try to hunt down these wolves of the sea, as they were called at the time. They basically did the same job as submarines did in World War I and World War II, except that they would remove the crew of the ships before they sank them. So there wasn't that much loss of life, but there was certainly a huge loss of materiel, goods, and ships as a consequence of this. And this was something that the Confederates really became very proficient at, especially Raphael Semmes, who was the commander of the Alabama. He was clearly the most proficient of these Commerce Raiders captains, and the Alabama did literally roam almost all the seven seas, the North Atlantic, the South Atlantic, the Indian Ocean. One of the Confederate Commerce Raiders, the CSS Shenandoah, which operated late in the war, went all the way up to the Bering Sea to attack and sink 20 or more ships of the New England whaling fleet. In fact, most of this actually happened after the war was over, but in June of 1865, but they didn't know that yet, that the war was over. So these commerce raiders were daring. They were romantic. They did cripple the American merchant fleet, the merchant marine, which never fully recovered from that, because so many ships had been driven into foreign registry by this process. In the long run, I don't think it advanced the Confederate war effort that much, but it certainly created a huge nuisance value.
Earlier on in the show, we discussed Cushing's raid, which I think is a great example in wartime. If you have a sharp, aggressive, and inventive junior officer, give him a mission and get out of his way, and it's amazing the effect they can get for very little investment. And I was really interested to see there's a couple of good examples on the Confederate side as well that I had never heard of. And I wanted to pick this story out for one of our regular listeners and former guest, Claude. He's a Mainer. But what was Reed's raid? How did it get started, and how did it end up in Portland, Maine?
Well, Lieutenant Reed was one of the officers on the Alabama. And he came up with the idea of taking one of the ships that the Alabama had captured and not sunk. And his initial idea was to carry out a raid into Hampton Roads and to cut out a couple of the Union naval ships there and take them out. It turned out that it was too carefully guarded for him to do that. But what he did was to roam along the North Atlantic coast from Maryland all the way up to New England, attacking whatever Union merchant ships he could find and fishing boats. He sank several of them. One of them turned out to be a better ship than the one he was using. So he seized that, and by that time the Union Navy had a description of the ship he was using to sink all of these merchant vessels along the North Atlantic coast, but he had already scuttled that ship and seized another one, and he worked his way all the way up to Portland, Maine. He went into the harbor at Portland, Maine, and cut out one of the revenue cutters, the U.S. Revenue Service, that's the forerunner of the Coast Guard. But by that time, the Union Navy and a lot of civilian sailors in the Portland area were hopping mad about this raider, and they came out and captured him. Sank his last raiding ship and finally captured him. But all of this was happening at the same time as the Gettysburg campaign on land in June and July of 1863, and it was another example of the kind of pinprick raids by the Confederate Navy that may not have had a major effect on the outcome of the war, but certainly didn't have a major effect on both Confederate morale, which it boosted, and Union morale, which it tended to depress.
One of the things I enjoyed about your book, too, was that you mentioned a few characters in there that had personalities that may not have pleased everyone in their peer group. So one of them was David Dixon Porter, who you kind of talked about a little bit, and the other one was Charles Wilkes, the former leader of the Great Exploring Expedition. Could you talk about them a little bit, and you know how they got away with being so abrasive and yet still maintain positions of power?
Well, Wilkes was more abrasive than Porter, more of a difficult personality. He was a real martinet. He had even been court-martialed after coming back from his great exploratory voyage in the 1840s for the brutal treatment of his sailors. He had the kind of personality that made enemies. He was not popular with other officers in the Navy, but he was he, in his career languished, his pre-war career languished as a consequence of that. But when the war broke out, every experienced commander wasn't needed. So Wells gave him command of a ship that was supposed to go after some of these Confederate commerce raiders. Wilkes instead decided that what he would do, he had learned from the U.S. attaché in the consul in Havana, Cuba, that a British merchant ship, a passenger ship, the Trent, was going to be sailing from Havana to London with the two Confederate envoys, James Mason and John Slidell, who were on their way to Europe to try to gain recognition, diplomatic recognition and financial aid for the Confederacy. He lay in wait in the old Bahama Channel in the Caribbean for the Trent and stopped it in international waters and took Mason and Slidell off. That created an international incident in which the British threatened war, demanded the return of Mason and Slidell, demanded an apology from the United States government. Wilkes was initially feted as a kind of hero for having seized Mason and Slidell and twisted the British lion's tail. But it became clear that if the British followed through on their threat to go to war against the United States because of this incident, that it would mean the United States was faced with two wars, one against the British and one against the Confederacy. And so the Lincoln administration and Secretary of State William Seward finally realized that they couldn't fight two wars at a time. And they basically returned Mason and Slidell to the British, really didn't apologize to the British, but the British accepted the return and the excuse that Wilkes had acted without order is sufficient. And it toned down that incident and did not lead to any kind of conflict with Britain. But Wilkes he was a loose cannon. He had done this entirely on his own authority, and he had almost brought the United States, created an international incident that had brought the United States to war. Porter was very ambitious, very much an egotist himself, sometimes willing to go behind the backs of other officers in order to advance his own ambitions. But he also turned out to be an extremely able commander. And in a way, that enabled him to get by with some of his underhanded operations. He was not particularly popular, but he was certainly effective. He had been in command of mortar schooners in Farragut's fleet in the attack on the forts below New Orleans on the Mississippi River, and had participated in that successful campaign. And then he participated in the first campaign against Vicksburg in 1862, which was not successful, but then became commander of the Mississippi Squadron, and worked very well in partnership with Grant and Sherman in the Vicksburg campaign, and they both thought very highly of Porter. Wells thought highly of him, too, while recognizing Porter's egotism, his tendency to his boastfulness, but also recognized his ability as a commander. So he gave him command of the attack on Fort Fisher in December 1864 and January 1865, which in mid-January 1865, in cooperation with Army troops, managed to capture Fort Fisher and shut down Wilmington as the last successful blockade-running port, which I think had a key impact in in leading to Appomattox and the surrender of Robert E. Lee's army, because once they shut down Wilmington as a blockade running port, that meant no more supplies coming in from abroad for the Army of Northern Virginia, and I think it was only a matter of time after that. So Porter, unlike Wilkes, was very successful and was not as much of a loose cannon, but he certainly was something of a braggart.
The Anaconda was a very appropriate name for what the overall operational plan for the Union Navy at the beginning of the war. Looking at the Confederate side, you know, there's something to be said. When you start with nothing, you have lots of options to go to. So building up from scratch, you know, the Confederate Navy, very small, but they were on the cutting edge of utilizing mines. We've talked about the submarine, the CSS Virginia, its other ironclads, being able to produce a lot with a little. But they also spent a lot of money and effort having commerce raiders from built in Britain and all the machinations that went into that. Looking at it in hindsight, when you look at, they didn't have much to work with, they only had so much they could contribute. When you look at what the Confederacy did they really best utilize their assets and their capabilities during the war from a naval point of view, or were there a couple of areas they probably could have invested less money on that could have been created a greater effect if it was invested in a different area?
Well, they invested a lot of resources in building ironclads on the model of the CSS Virginia, and that used up a lot of very scarce resources, especially iron, in the Confederacy, and labor. There was a real shortage of skilled shipwright-type labor in the Confederacy. And a lot of these ironclads had to be destroyed when they were partially completed, because it took so long to build them, and the Union Navy had moved in, and that happened in New Orleans. The Confederates were building two big ironclads on the lower Mississippi to help defend New Orleans in early 1862, the CSS Mississippi and the CSS Louisiana. The Louisiana had been completed, except for its engine, when the Union forces moved in, and basically they had to blow it up. And the Mississippi wasn't even as far along as that, and they had to blow that up. There was the first CSS Tennessee in Memphis, when the Union Navy moved down, and the River Navy moved down from the north and captured Memphis in June of 1862, and they had to blow up the CSS Tennessee on the stocks as well. And I think that if the Confederates had put a little bit more into some of their other naval operations early in the war, rather than trying to build these very large ironclads, they might have been better off. The success of the CSS Virginia in Hampton Roads on March 8, 1862, may have in the end been a handicap for the Confederacy, because it created a kind of ironclad fad, an ironclad craze in the Confederacy, and maybe that wasn't what they should have been pouring their resources into.
Well, Professor McPherson, I really appreciate you joining us today. I don't want to run too much more of your time. We could probably spend several days on this book. It's a
probably
great book.
Could.
And for those of us who are former or current naval officers and love to talk about this sort of thing, what have you got coming up next? What can we look forward to from you? And
I'm actually doing a book on Jefferson Davis as Commander-in-Chief. So that'll be my next book. I'm venturing into a new area for myself on that book. But I did a book 5 years ago on Lincoln as Commander in Chief, and the publisher persuaded me to do a kind of twin of that book on Jefferson Davis. So that's what I've been working on.
Well, I know we look forward to it, And again, thank you very much for coming on, and it's been a great show. And maybe sometime we can get you back on and discuss more aspects of the Civil War. Really enjoy it.
Okay. I'd love to do that, and I enjoyed it very much. Enjoyed talking with you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, Professor McPherson, and I look forward to that story on Jefferson Davis. Too bad we lost his house in the hurricane a while back. But I want to thank everybody for joining us live, and we look forward to seeing you again for the next episode.